right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And once again, we have a hell of a show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking to the director and two of the actors from a very powerful play. And it's the play is called Wedding Band, A Love's Hate Story in Black and White. Before that, we'll be talking with David Quammen, who's written a book on Ebola and the spread of Ebola, a scientific explanation of Ebola, something that we need really, really urgently right now. It's called Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus. But opening the show up is something and someone that I've been waiting to talk to for a little while. Basically, it's a question that we've covered a lot in this show, mass incarceration. You know, we've been involved in the whole Stop Mass Incarceration movement, giving it a lot of play, a lot of support. And I came on this book just recently, and the book is called Mass Incarceration on Trial, A Remarkable Court Decision and the Future of Prisons in America. And it's by a man named Jonathan Simon. And for nearly 40 years, the U.S. has been gripped by policies that have placed more than 2.5 million Americans in jails and prisons designed to hold a fraction of that number of inmates. Jonathan Simon focuses on California, and he calls it the Mississippi of mass incarceration and the widespread human rights violations that have accompanied the shocking numbers of people locked up. Jonathan is the Adrian A. Cragen Professor of Law at Bolt Law School at Berkeley, and I'm very happy to welcome him to the show. Jonathan, welcome.
I'm very glad to be on. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Great.
I was worried for a minute there. I thought, whoa, wait. They came and got him. Anyway, let's jump into this. As I said, you talk about California as the Mississippi of mass incarceration. What do you mean?
So, you know, for those of us old enough to remember the 60s, Mississippi came to embody Jim Crow segregation, which of course existed in many other states, but it probably epitomized the worst and most degrading forms of that. Sadly, I'm afraid, I think California today, a place that kind of rose up in opposition to Mississippi back in the 60s, at least students did, has become that for mass incarceration. We're the state that epitomizes how to do it the worst. And that's pretty striking for a state that, unlike Mississippi, doesn't suffer, at least nationally, from being, you know, extremely poor and excluded from the economy.
You talk about it in your book, and it seems for a lot of people who have any knowledge of, like you're saying, the reputation of California and knew what California was in the 60s and even before that in terms of a more liberal bent, and in particularly in the 60s, where it became one of the center points, one of the focal points of this whole uprising in society and this whole challenging of everything that was the norm in the old way, in the old world way of doing things, you know, all of the things around mass incarceration, including around, you know, what there wasn't mass incarceration, including around what was going on with prisoners, the rebellions in the streets. How the hell did this get to this? How did California become the Mississippi of mass incarceration?
Well, it was right after that sort of very hopeful moment that you're describing, which was certainly fraught, but in the 60s and the early 70s, when there was actually a lot of discussion of prisoner rights, a very active media and social movement concerned with the fate of prisoners. We had a much smaller prison population, but a lot of the same worries about racism and discrimination inside it. But within a few years, the state had really changed around this. And I think it was a combination of high crime rates, which certainly were being highly politicized by rising tide of politicians. This is something I described in my earlier book. It was also facilitated by social science. I want to put some blame on my own social vocation, most of whose research seemed to suggest that we couldn't really solve the crime problem through rehabilitating people, through educating them. Even police were getting a bad social science reputation in terms of not being able to do much. And so I think in many ways, both conservatives and liberals by the end of the 70s had embraced a very pessimistic and, of course, racially, I think, charged commitment to using prison as a kind of punitive segregation way to get California out of what was a pretty serious escalation in violent crime. Now, the crime eventually went down for reasons that nobody really understands well, but our commitment to prison as a way to keep ourselves safe has not been really challenged until right now, when we finally see, you know, social movements like the one against mass incarceration and even voters coming out to support decarceration.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I kept thinking about as I was reading your book, and particularly on this subject, you know, that whole point about Nixon and Haldeman and Ehrlichman and the whole point in the 70s and the early 70s when they said, you know, they had this conference and they said, look, you know, we get the problem is the black people, and we have to figure out a way that we can deal with that without making it look like that's what we're dealing with and that's what we're saying. And the whole war on drugs that got unleashed on this, and which really did change the whole face of, you know, imprisonment and law enforcement in the country.
And we're just beginning to peel that back now. We began with police. We basically doubled the number of police in American cities between 65 and 75. And then beginning in the 70s, we began to build out the carceral side of it. So we've got a lot of work to do if we're going to begin to dismantle this very, very large edifice, which has, as we saw in Ferguson in terms of police, and we see in Brown versus Plata in terms of prisons, a deeply inhumane and, can I say it, un-American, you know, aspect to it.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to get into that in just a minute, but I wanted to just chase a few more things, because part of this, one of the things that really got me about your book, too, is that you talk about the way that not only the physical elements changed in terms of who was in prison, how many were in prison, what prisons were like, but you also talked about a whole change in the philosophical view around prison, that there was a disappearance of any sense of rehabilitation and an establishment of something you call total incapacitation. First, what's that? What's it mean? And where did it come from?
Right. That's been very important. So incapacitation itself is a completely rational kind of idea. It basically says one way prison could prevent crime, even if it doesn't rehabilitate people and even if it doesn't scare other people into not committing crimes, is simply by physically preventing somebody who would otherwise be actively committing crimes from doing so. And limited to an attempt to interrupt a particular individual's kind of escalating crime pattern, it may make some sense. But what total incapacitation was about, and it came out of these fear years of the 70s where there was a lot of crime and a sense that nothing worked, was this combination of thinking every felon poses the full range of risk. The person who's stealing a rake out of your garage could be the next Charles Manson. Remember, this is the 70s where there are a lot of serial killings being reported on a regular basis. We don't know how to change them, and they'll be the same that they are for the rest of their lives. And the only way we can make sure that they won't harm their neighbor is by physically removing them. That was basically what I call the kind of common sense that a lot of Californians, both elites and ordinary citizens, began to draw. Certainly, it had a racial undercurrent to it. We can talk more about that. But that deeply pessimistic view committed us, really, to building not only building a vast array of prisons, but then filling it with far more prisoners than we could even hold in those, all committed to the idea that any time any prisoner leaves, at least early, that they're posing a risk to the rest of us. And that, I think one of the things that's allowing change on that now is that that set of assumptions is, while made some sense in the 70s, is so deeply flawed that it's really pretty hard to defend or sustain.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because when you're saying that, I was living up in San Francisco in the, like around 1974, and I was thinking about the Zodiac Killer and what was unleashed in relation to that, where there was a constant, I mean, you didn't walk, you know, you saw people walking down the street and they were, if a black person happened to just come down the same sidewalk as them, there was an immediate, you know, like, oh my God, what's going to happen here? You know, because it was this whole idea that there's a killer black person out there and it could be anybody, maybe it's all of them, you know? And it was that whole kind of thing that built up the kind of public opinion in support of one of the most heinous things that's come down the pike in a long time. I mean, it really is a savage situation that has developed here.
And it, you know, came out of a very pessimistic time. I mean, hopefully we'll have time to talk about the fact that, you know, one of the reasons we're, I think, seeing change is, you know, crime rates are at historic lows. And it's not because of mass incarceration. I mean, it doesn't have any good criminological, you know, association with mass incarceration. In fact, states that didn't mass incarcerate as much as California have done much even better at crime decline. But it has made it possible for us to see how foolish this basic model is. I mean, the truth is people change. Even if we don't rehabilitate people in prison, and I'm something of a skeptic that we know much about how to do that, the life course itself changes people. And incarcerating people for decades, even if they have committed pretty serious crimes, say in their 20s, doesn't make very much sense. And of course, once you're incarcerating people in their 50s and 60s, you're talking about almost inherently degrading circumstances.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Jonathan Simon, author of Mass Incarceration on Trial, A Remarkable Court Decision and the Future of Prisons in America. Now, Jonathan, I do want to get into something that I think is actually, you know, at the heart of a lot of what you're arguing in the book. And I'm in a quandary because I also want to talk about where these, you know, basically supermax prisons fit into all this. Well, maybe we can get into that first. Where do the supermax prisons get into this? Because that also was taking incarceration to a whole new place.
So it's a great example of how total incapacitation as a penal kind of philosophy wasn't just about putting the maximum number of people in prison for the maximum length of time. It was also about dealing inside the prison in a way that treated everybody as a potential Hannibal Lecter. So the whole image of the supermax prison is one of containing a monster. I talk about it as a sort of zombie apocalypse model of what the crime problem was, that you've got this kind of predatory criminal that is going to be attacking other prisoners and prison officers. Now, that had a tiny, tiny, tiny glimmer of reality in the early 70s when there was a fair amount of very politically oriented prison violence. But by the 80s, actually, that was not even accurate at all, and yet it became baked into California's penal policies and much of the rest of the country. It is just shocking that as late as this spring, we were still using supermax custody, that kind of 23-hour day lockdown, on mentally ill prisoners until the court finally ordered us to stop doing it.
Yeah, and that leads right into this next question, which is, you've come at a very unique way to hit at all this, to hit at mass incarceration and everything that comes with it, by focusing on health care, mental health care, and you focus on the treatment of the mentally ill with regard, like you're saying, to the supermax and other manifestations of mass incarceration today. And you do that to highlight the denial of basic human rights, to build a case for Eighth Amendment violations. What made you go here?
You know, I was looking through the window of these cases, I saw something I hadn't seen before, which is that this kind of formidable Death Star-like thing, mass incarceration, actually does seem to have a soft underbelly, a point of vulnerability. And that point of vulnerability is that it is accumulating in its prisons not the most dangerous people in the state, but some of the sickest people in the state in terms of chronic illness, in terms of diabetes, in terms of cancer and HIV, and mental illness above all, and often interrelated with all of those. And those do two things. One, they mean that prison becomes incredibly expensive over time in a way that I think the state will find unsustainable. As we're moving toward an older, aging population, we're going to go from about $60,000 per prisoner per year now to probably well over $100,000. And we won't be able to afford to pay for UC, CSU, even community colleges at that point, even with realignment. So it is going to force a day of judgment. But the other side, and why we can't wait for that, is it creates unbelievable degradation, both for the people who are in prison who are experiencing that. I mean, to suffer from the kind of medical decline is something that even my colleague John Yu would agree is torture. I mean, if you're suffering from these serious illnesses and the pain they cause and the despair they cause. And, of course, the correctional officers who have to work in this situation are also degraded by that same experience. So I think it's imperative that Californians realize that this is like Guantanamo in every county. We've got, you know, dozens of prisons in the state that are really human rights problems.
Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the things that really struck me in your book is you talk about the medical situation in prison, and what you present is sort of the savage violence on one hand, but then also cruelty through deliberate indifference to very serious health problems. And it's sort of robbing the people of their humanity, and it points to a much more clearly to a systemic problem.
It does. I mean, if somebody's on a scaffold, to avoid torturing them, you just avoid hurting them directly, humiliating them. Or in a prison, you need to be proactive to make sure they're not tortured. If somebody has diabetes and they don't get their diabetes medicine, that is going to be a tortuous death. And California essentially built prisons that it anticipated would operate at 2 to 3 times their size based on the amount of electricity and sewer capacity they built, and didn't even build in the basic infrastructure for mental health care or medical care. And that's where I think you begin to see this as a kind of a human rights thing. If you were in Europe, this would be the kind of thing that would be being investigated, and people would be potentially facing charges for having authorized these prisons, etc. We're not in Europe, but I think going forward, we have to demand that level of accountability of our state officials.
Hmm. Well, one of the things that you say, and by the way, people, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Jonathan Simon, author of Mass Incarceration on Trial, A Remarkable Court Decision and the Future of Prisons in America. Now, Jonathan, one of the things that you talk about, and I'd like you to give a few examples of this so people can get an understanding. When I was reading your book, I just got pulled in more and more and more and more outraged as I read what actually was revealed in some of these court cases that came up, the level of depravity in terms of how people were treated with serious health problems. It was really, really intense. Can you give people a few examples of that?
Well, it got to the Supreme Court, too. I mean, on the physical side of it, we're talking about people suffering experiences like heart attacks, you know, in which they're experiencing chest pain for hours, but being declined even contact with medical providers. One case that the Supreme Court, in addition, included in its opinion involved a young prisoner who died of testicular cancer after 17 months of pain and asking for help. And we know, of course, testicular cancer can be very well treated if you get to it. On the mental side, these cages where they put psychotic, mentally ill prisoners that they feared would commit suicide, I think particularly got to the court as just so inherently degrading to have, you know, stripped down naked prisoners suffering severe symptoms of mental illness sitting in, again, often their own urine and defecation, made the court literally gag. And I think that's where you began to get this demand that California basically implement some basic human rights in its prisons, even if it had to do so by reducing its prison population by this historic 40,000.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about this. You refer to something in there that really caught my eye, too, which was torture on the installment plan. And I know where it comes from, or maybe you could tell people where that comes from, but you actually apply this to what's going on in California prisons now.
Yeah, so, well, the installment plan may be a bad metaphor since I don't know if anyone actually buys things with installment plans back in our day. People would, you know, put some money down and then make regular payments to get something. And, of course, if you didn't make a payment, sometimes you lost the whole thing. That's why it was a bad deal. But the thing about torture on the installment plan is, again, we think of torture historically as having somebody directly impacting you with pain over the short term, like being waterboarded. But I am arguing that when we build prisons that cause chronic illnesses like diabetes and cancer and HIV and mental illness to take deeper and deeper roots in individuals such that they're going to suffer pain over a lifetime caused by that deepening, we're really doing a new kind of torture, one that hasn't been done before in history, at least on this scale. And I guess the only good news there is, insofar as the Obamacare survives, taxpayers are going to also have to pay for the health care for those years in which people's deepened illness are going to be inflicted on the community, because they're going to come out of prison. But they're going to have to bear the suffering of that really torture-like experience that anybody who's suffering from chronic illness can tell you about.
Mm-hmm. You know, and when you talk about that, I'm also thinking about the sort of caliber of the medical professionals that are in the prisons now. And you talk about that, how at one point there was actually people who were really trying to do some things. There were doctors who were, you know, were really actually caring doctors who were in there. There were psychologists who were in there. But today it seems like you have, in your book, you talk about how healthcare and health providers are now viewed as part of the problem by prison officials if they really care about this, or they actually are part of the problem. That is, they're allied with the administration and their healthcare becomes custodial, not medical care. Let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, so I don't want to exaggerate how good the past was. There were a lot of really nasty features in California's penal medical profile in, say, the mid-century, including experiments that were done on prisoners. But there were two things that were true. One is progressive states like California viewed crime as a disease, and therefore they very much invested in having psychiatrists, psychologists, and medical doctors involved in the administration of prison, and there was sort of a medical authority. And they paid a lot of attention to prisoners as individuals. After all, parole existed, so the individual behavior of a prisoner. Famously, at San Quentin, the librarian even kept meticulous records on which books prisoners read. So there was a kind of knowledge of, and at least the capacity to care for prisoners as individuals. When California launched on its experiment with mass incarceration, it abandoned that whole history and instead committed itself to this kind of warehouse model of how big can you build it, how high security can you make it, how many people can you squeeze into it. And in that mix, medical professionals had no place. They were just an expensive and unnecessary element. For the correctional officers, who at one time had been, as their name suggests, oriented at least in professional title toward corrections and rehabilitation, at this time, again, took a very much of a view that prisoners were dangerous, were really intractable, and sometimes weren't even worthy of being treated as human. And in that context, the last thing they wanted was medical professionals in those settings who would essentially, presumably if they were committed to their professional obligations, demand that prisoners receive the treatment due human beings. And we've actually seen an important victory in that regard just in the last few months when in the Coleman case, which is the longest running part of the saga, the judge, Judge Carlton, just ordered, and the state essentially agreed, that they will now have mental health professionals essentially stand in between correctional officers and mentally ill prisoners before things like cell extraction or tasing or pepper spraying can be used on those prisoners, something that was going on just until this spring.
Now, Jonathan, we have time for one more question. I wanted to ask you this because it's a big part of where you seem to be coming from on all this, and it's an important part. The whole question that you referred to earlier in terms of this is humanity, and there's a question of human dignity. And in relation to, you know, what you've pointed out as really Eighth Amendment constitutional violations, You know, you've talked about the need for people to recognize and for, you know, everyone to recognize the humanity of the people who are imprisoned and to basically step back and say, look, there's a need for people to really fight for the recognition of the humanity and also the dignity that comes with that. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is it's not often that our Supreme Court sort of gives us a kind of moral lesson for the nation. And I think this is one. Brown versus Board of Education is another. But here, Justice Kennedy said in very simple terms, prisoners retain their humanity. That's a very simple idea. But what's shocking is that it was an idea that had essentially been lost, not only in California, but really in American corrections and in American courts. I think Justice Kennedy, who's from California and has kind of watched this situation evolve, had himself been pushed from being a pretty conservative justice on this. In 2003, he upheld our three strikes law, voted to uphold it, to someone who really saw that not only the humanity of prisoners, but our humanity is at stake if we're going to tolerate prisons that essentially, as he put it in the opinion, have no place in civilization. So my hope is going forward with the activism I see around the community on this now, the social movements that are demanding an end to mass incarceration, actually finding resonance at the highest level of our legal system, I think that's a very positive sign for the possibility of change here.
All right, Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, take care now, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Jonathan Simon, author of Mass Incarceration on Trial, A Remarkable Court Decision and the Future of Prisons in America. Teddy, let's get a little bit of Curtis Mayfield, and people get ready.
Just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers humming. Don't need no ticket. You just thank the Lord. So people get ready for the train to join.
Okay, over the last couple of months, people have been sort of, for a while, they were riveted to television, to newspapers, to stories coming out about the epidemic of the Ebola virus in West Africa, West and Central Africa. And through the course of this, there was a lot of trash that was put out and a lot of things that laid the basis for and actually did stoke up some very bad things, xenophobia, the kind of pogromish atmosphere where kids come back from visiting their families in Africa and get beat up and all this stuff. And so I wanted to try and present a scientific view of Ebola. And I was looking around for someone who had done that in a very thorough sense and somebody who could actually talk about the disease in a scientific way. And I found that person. His name is David Quammen. And David is the author of the book Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus. And he's a contributor for National Geographic magazine. And I'm very happy to welcome him to the show today. David, welcome.
It's good to be with you, Michael.
I wanted to talk about this. We're now in the midst of what you've called and others have called the worst outbreak of the Ebola virus ever, although it now seems that this has receded from the news in this country. And it's something that we can talk about a little bit, I hope. You know, what do you see as this? It's, you know, the big question is, where did this come from? When people look at this, where did it come from? And on this scale in particular, but also generally.
Yeah, well, the first answer is Ebola virus comes from the African forest. It has to live in some other creature because viruses can only replicate in living cells. It has spilled over into humans more than 20 times in the last 40 years, first noticed in 1976. So there have been these outbreaks, more than 20 of them, and none of them previously had killed more than about 300 people. Total was about 1,600 fatalities in all these previous outbreaks. And now we're over, we're somewhere, I think, over 5,000 fatalities in this one. So this one is no longer an outbreak. As you say, it's an epidemic now in West Africa. But it all began with the spillover of the virus from one animal into one human being, probably in the southeastern corner of Guinea last December. The first known case was a little 2-year-old boy. He got sick and died, then his mother got sick and died, his sister, his grandmother, they all died in this one little village. We still don't know which animal Ebola virus hides in, but whatever it was, it got from that animal into these people in this little village in southeastern Guinea, and then started passing from person to person.
Let me ask you this, David. You wrote your book in the style of sort of, a certain sense that there's like a little bit of a detective story in there. It's related to what you've just been saying about one of the critical aspects, one of the points that you focus on a lot in your book is exactly that point of the search for a host or a reservoir for the virus, and then the actual mechanism for how it gets transmitted from the reservoir to humans. Why is this the critical point, and where are we at on that?
Well, we still don't know, as I said, what the reservoir host is. You hear people say, well, it's fruit bats. There is suspicion that it is fruit bats. There has been some circumstantial evidence, but there has been no rock-solid evidence that fruit bats of any species are the reservoir host. They're still trying to solve that. And as you say, my book is written sort of as a mystery story, and with each of these diseases, the first mystery is where does it come from and why, and then these disease detectives go out and try and solve that mystery. But the reason it's spilled over into humans from this animal, whatever it is, presumably has to do with the way people interact with wild animals in the countryside, in the forest of Central and West Africa. In other words, bushmeat. People are starved for protein. They eat the animals. They eat wildlife, including bats. And in doing that, they expose themselves to the viruses that these creatures carry. That's what's happened with Ebola. Why is it important to know which animal? Well, it can't help us, it probably can't help us stop the current epidemic to know what the reservoir host is, but it can help a lot in preventing future spillovers and future epidemics.
Well, you know, there was something, and I think I read it either in your book or in an article you had written recently related to this. I mean, it was very interesting because there was a point about how if it was fruit bats, say, that was the animal, then the solution would not necessarily be to go and eradicate all fruit bats from the face of the earth. That would actually cause even more problems if that was done.
Right, absolutely. These different species of bat and all these other animals, they have their ecological roles within the diverse ecosystems where they live. And so if we discovered, for instance, that fruit bat species X was the reservoir host of Ebola, there would be a lot of pressure from people saying, oh, we should eradicate that species. But that would cause problems. That would cause cascading effects of one sort or another in the forest. What we have to realize is that there are essentially three options dealing with this kind of a situation once you identify the reservoir. You can decide you're going to eradicate the reservoir species, bad idea for ecological reasons. You can try and cure the reservoir species, eradicate the virus from the reservoir species. That's very hard to do. Think about trying to cure an entire population of rodents or bats or monkeys or whatever in the African forests. Just impracticable. And the third possible approach is just identify the reservoir and then keep people separate from it. Educate people, give people opportunities, give people options for other things to eat so that they can leave that reservoir host alone and not give it the opportunity to spill its virus into humans. And the third of those is the one that really needs to be pursued once we identify the reservoir.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with David Quammen. David's the author of Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus, and a contributor for National Geographic magazine. Now, David, a related question to all this is that you talk about one of the difficulties in your book is in investigating the virus in humans is that it's the transitory nature of the outbreaks of the disease, that it hits and then it recedes into dormancy for years. Who knows how long? Who knows where it's going to appear again? And this is a huge problem. How do you deal with that? How does that affect both the course of these epidemics and these outbreaks and also the fight to actually figure out how to eradicate the disease?
Well, it is difficult because scientists can only study this when there is an outbreak. I mean, they can take samples of Ebola and grow it in the laboratory, but in terms of understanding the disease dynamics, the spillover mechanism, they have to be there when that's happening, and Ebola spills over into humans and it causes this outbreak situation, and it's emergency. People are sick, people are dying, so scientists go in there, public health people, healthcare workers go in there, and they try and deal with the human tragedy that's happening. And it's difficult to do the scientific research at the same time. It's almost a luxury that they don't have. And then when the outbreak is brought to a halt, the virus disappears. Where is it? Well, it's in its reservoir host. What species is that? We don't know. And so it's difficult to study in between outbreaks. But there are some brilliant and dedicated and courageous scientists who have been working in the forests of Central and West Africa for years and decades now, in between outbreaks, sampling animals, taking blood samples from animals of all different sorts and looking for the Ebola virus. That work has been going on. Not many people, but some of them I know, I've spent time in the forest with them. That's the real detective work that's happening behind the scenes. And the fact that they have not yet found the reservoir host of Ebola, they have not yet isolated live Ebola virus from any species of animal in the Central African forest, is part of what compounds the mystery of this particular virus, this particular disease. It's really been a tough nut to crack.
And the approach that you're taking with this book of actually doing science reporting from that standpoint, and what you bring out about the scientists themselves and about the various medical professionals and all the people that work with infectious diseases and all this, and the fact that you brought out in this book, I thought was really important, that there's the element of really applying the science, but then you talked about people who also went in and listened to the people who were affected by this and actually listened to the things that were wrong, the things that were superstitions, but also what they could glean from them in terms of how did the disease progress? You know, maybe get a hint of where it was picked up from and who got it, who died, who didn't, all this other stuff. And I thought that was very important.
I agree. It is important. And for instance, there's a fellow I met at an Ebola conference in Africa named Barry Hewlett. He's a medical anthropologist. I didn't even know that the profession of medical anthropologist existed. But he goes into these communities where Ebola is killing people or where it has struck, and he talks to people. He talks to people about their traditional beliefs. He talks to people about the community dynamics, who's angry at whom. And he's written a book about this, about Ebola in particular, the sort of the traditional belief practices and the cultural anthropology of this terrible disease. Different ethnic groups in Central and West Africa have different ways of viewing this, but there's a certain amount of overlap. They tend to attribute these outbreaks to sorcery, to some sort of malign spirits. In some cases, it's almost as though someone were believed to have put a curse on someone else, and the result is these chains of disease. They tend not to think of it as a virus. They tend to be suspicious of Western medicine, but they have their own ways of explaining these things. Now, in some cases, those beliefs cause them a lot of trouble, cause them misery, because it includes burial practices that expose more and more people to the virus. But Barry Hewlett and the people like him who study these cultures realize that you can't just go in there and tell people that they're wrong. Tell people, stop doing that. Stop cleaning the bodies of your loved ones before you bury them. You have to stop doing it. You can't simply dictate to them. You have to absorb the traditional beliefs with respect and then give people options and guide them away to safer practices that allow them to avoid these kinds of situations.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with David Quammen. David's the author of Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus, and a contributor for National Geographic magazine. You know, it's interesting, David, because that's something that I think is actually also well worth thinking about in relation to how things have developed here in this country, where you have, in the wake of this and attached to the epidemic in Africa, you have this sort of xenophobia and this pogromish atmosphere being whipped up, a lot based on the idea that people think, well, if someone looks at me wrong or they breathe in my direction, I'll get Ebola. And on the basis of that, there's terrible things happening, including, you know, the beating of little children that have just returned from a visit to someplace in Africa, and, you know, all people being isolated. And if you get sick, you know, and you're African, you're basically suspect immediately, and they want to quarantine you, or who knows what's going to happen. And combating that can only happen with this kind of scientific approach that you're advocating.
Well, yes, and there's a tremendous amount of fear in this country, in the U.S., about Ebola, partly because it's such a lethal disease. It kills, you know, a high percentage of the people that it infects, but partly because of misunderstanding. People have been led by some previous publications to believe that Ebola is this spooky, mysterious disease that causes people to dissolve on the inside. It's incredibly bloody. People bleed bloody tears. In fact, those are myths. That's not true about Ebola. It is a horrible disease. The virus kills a lot of people. It does not cause organs to dissolve. It does not cause most of its victims to bleed inordinately. It kills in other ways. So that misconception has partly led to this high level of fear. And as you said, people tend to be ignorant of Africa. Most people have never been to Africa. They have only the dimmest ideas of Africa. And here's a virus that comes from the African forest. Ooh, the African forest. That makes it more terrifying. I try to get around that in my book. I've spent a lot of time in the African forests of Central Africa, particularly, and they're beautiful places. with a lot of diversity, including Ebola virus. But it's just a virus. It's not a preternatural miasma. It's not a spooky thing. It's just a virus that transmits in bodily fluids and can be stopped with proper precautions and equipment.
Now, I want to ask you a couple more questions. One is this point that you've made in a number of places about evolution and the virus, and that just as worrisome as the virus's geographic spread is its journey across the evolutionary landscape. Tell me what you're talking about there, and then what are the possible repercussions of this?
Right. Well, people wonder, is Ebola virus evolving? Is it going to adapt toward being more lethal in humans, maybe toward being a respiratory virus transmissible through the air? We know from good science that's been done since this outbreak began, some of it published in the journal Science in early September, we know that Ebola virus is mutating. But that's almost a truism. Viruses always mutate. They make mistakes copying themselves. This is a particular kind of virus that has a relatively high rate of mutation. So it has been mutating more during this epidemic because it's infecting more humans. The more people it infects, the more opportunities it has to mutate. But it's important to distinguish that from adapting. Mutation is random change, mistakes in copying its genome. Adaptation is Darwinian natural selection, taking those random mutations and selecting for the ones that cause the survival of the fittest, the survival of the fittest virus. There is no evidence so far that Ebola virus during this outbreak has been adapting to be more dangerous in human. It's possible that it could happen, and the higher the case count goes, the greater the possibility. But in terms of the randomness of mutation, the case count is still relatively low, and scientists are watching that carefully. So we shouldn't be alarmed that this is going to become an airborne virus through mutation. We should be aware of the fact that the longer the outbreak, the epidemic goes on, the better the chances of the virus mutating in some way that might make our prototype vaccines ineffective against it or might make it more problematic in other ways, but it's not likely to become an airborne virus.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with David Quammen. David's the author of Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus, and a contributor for National Geographic Magazine. Just a follow-up here, because I thought I remember reading in your book the point about when they looked at this, that mutations over the last 10 years have been proceeding at a really phenomenal rate. And I was sort of wondering what that would mean.
Now, let me distinguish a little bit. Mutations over the course of this year during the outbreak in West Africa have been higher than usual. The mutation rate has been up. And they have found that there are five species of Ebola virus, and one of them is known as Zaire Ebola virus from Central Africa. And this virus in West Africa is part of that species, but it has diverged from that species by about 10 years worth of mutations. So what that seems to suggest is that the virus is moving, that this strain of the virus in West Africa has diverged from the Central African Ebola virus over the last 10 years and moved into a new area, either perhaps because the reservoir host has been migrating. If it's bats, maybe the bats have been migrating, or because the virus has been moving through a population of reservoir hosts and the virus itself has been expanding its range. In either case, that's a little bit disturbing over the longer term. It's not knowledge that helps us stop this outbreak, but it's something that we need to take into account in terms of what comes next, what happens next year and the year after, how to prevent future outbreaks of Ebola virus. We need to be aware that the virus seems to be moving.
All right, David, the argument you make for basically people stepping back, taking a deep breath and looking at things from the standpoint not of, oh, how can we escape this horror and all this other stuff, but that actually the whole way that the fight against Ebola has to be carried out has so much to do and really would hinge on the idea that people here and people everywhere in the world have to do as much as they can to fight the disease where it is now in Africa. And not from the standpoint of get it there before it gets us, but from the standpoint of the situation facing humanity in that part of the world. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. When there was a case in the U.S. and then a couple of secondary transmissions, we got very obsessed with the idea of how to protect ourselves in this country. Should we close borders? Should we screen people at airports and have mandatory quarantine? And in the midst of all that debate and kerfuffle and confusion, there's a tendency to forget that no matter what we do in this country, the right thing to do and the necessary thing to do for all concerned is to give all possible aid and support to ending the epidemic in West Africa. We can institute airport protocols in this country, but we will never completely protect ourselves from the possibility of an infected person arriving until the epidemic has ended in West Africa. And equally or more important, we need, on sheer humanitarian grounds, because it's the right thing to do, we need to continue sending help, to send more help, the entire international community. We need to be sending more help, more material, more experts, more brave volunteers, healthcare experts, to West Africa to stop this epidemic there. Nobody will be completely safe anywhere in the world until this outbreak ends in West Africa.
You know, and quite frankly, even if we were safe, it wouldn't be worth it if it was at the cost of all these people in Africa just continually dying and who knows what happening in relation to this.
Amen to that, Michael.
You know, I was reading the LA Times last week, and they had an article about, well, hallelujah, the people who get Ebola in the U.S. aren't dying. And they talk about the reason is because we have the equipment, we have the facilities, we have this. And then you look at the listing of the equipment that's required to actually save a life. And it's not rocket science there. You know, it's like, yes,
right,
there's advanced stuff, but there's like just the right type of tubing and the various machines to deal with the disease as it progresses. And it's concentrated in these metropoles in the U.S. and Western Europe, but the rest of the world has no access to that at all. And it was really stunning to me.
That's right. That struck me, too. And the fact that the case fatality rate seems to be going down, that we've had much better than 50% case fatality in this country so far, is a reminder, and I may have said this in my book, I can't remember, but it's a reminder that what's been happening in West Africa doesn't just tell us about the ugly facts of the Ebola virus. It tells us about the ugly facts of poverty and underserved populations and absence of decent health care in those countries in West Africa. That's what it represents as much as anything.
All right, David, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks very much. And good questions. I'm glad that we got to dig into it a little deeper than usually is possible. A real pleasure to talk with you.
You too, man. Thanks a lot. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with David Quammen. David is the author of the book Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus. He's also a contributing writer to National Geographic magazine. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with members of the cast of Wedding Band, so stay tuned. Teddy, before we get to Wedding Band, let's hear a little Irma Thomas right now, because I think that's going to put me in the mood, all right?
Sometimes I wonder just what I'm fighting for. I win some battles, but I always lose the war. I keep right on stumbling in this no man's land out there. But I know, yes I know, there must be a better world somewhere.
There must be a better world out there, all right? That's Irma Thomas, and that just, I felt that was so just linked to this play that I want to talk with people about. The play is called Wedding Band, a love-hate story in black and white. And just to kick this off, let me give people just a little hint of what the play is, and then my guests can fill in the rest, all right? It was written by Alice Childress, the great black playwright Alice Childress. It was written in 1962, and it's set in the southern United States against the backdrop of World War I. And it tells the story of the terrible racist oppression brought down by this system and the whole culture it promotes throughout society in terms of the relations between people. It's a really powerful play. I'm really happy to welcome to the show today two of the cast members and the director. Greg Daniels, the director. Greg, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And I have the people who are the two leads in the story, about whom the play is, in one sense, is about the love relationship between a black woman and a white man. And joining us today is Verlyn Jones. Verlyn, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And John Prosky. John, welcome.
How you doing? Thanks.
Good, good. Which one of you wants to tell the story of what the play is about?
Oh, that would be the director.
Okay.
By default.
Well, it takes place in 1918, the final war years, and it's a relationship. It was a 10-year relationship between an African-American woman and a Caucasian male at a time when the South did have anti-miscegenation laws on the books, which forbade people of different races from mixing together under penalty of being arrested, and worse things could happen also. People took matters into their own hands. So it charts this 10-year relationship on this particular day when they're supposedly celebrating. But of course, the past sneaks up on them. Racial politics sneaks up on them. Economic, social, feminist, all these issues sneak up on them. And to profile where these people are after 10 years of conducting this covert relationship.
You know, one of the things that got me there too is that it's a story between Verlin, your character, and John, your character. Mm-hmm. But it also, and it's really intense because what gets concentrated in that is, in a way, the stories of all the other characters as well, you know, and what they're living through, and a bigger story in terms of the whole historical oppression of black people, you know, and how that's played out and continues to play out in society today. Verlin, what did your character in particular, what did you think of that? Because you play someone who, one, is in love, but then also your relationship isn't approved by the white power structure, but nor is it approved by the black people that you're living with. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, it's a really interesting situation that she's in because, as you say, she's an outcast with her people. She's actually disenfranchised from them, and she has no leg in the with the white race either. So she's living basically in a covert world, and she has no relationships that she could build on. She's really isolated. And I think the anniversary that they're celebrating now is a big one because now that she's moved into this particular neighborhood, and it's the first time that she's really had the opportunity to tell her story with the women that she is now living in this neighborhood with. And she, for the first time, makes a relationship. And that's when the whole story kind of gets going because now she wants to build this relationship and she sees that it's impossible. So for the first time, she opens up, and now there's a way in for her to have a relationship with some of the women in her own race. And she has to deal with their feelings about the whole relationship, and then it's complicated with the war and the influenza. So it's a really loaded period of time, and it's just when you think about two people not being able to express their love to each other because somebody else is legislating how they should be with each other, and that it leaves them really outside of a community. They have no place to really be outside of in this one room where they celebrate their lives, basically. So mm-hmm. it's a difficult time. It's loaded for them.
And John, your character is very complex as well. I mean, there's a point there where, you know, you come onto the stage and, you know, if you have any sympathies at all for the situation that's being portrayed, you think, oh, good, this is a nice guy. You guys ought to get together. This is a nice guy. But you also have the situation which gets revealed as you go along, that there's a little bit more sort of not so good stuff that's actually part of your makeup as well.
It's interesting. The more we were in rehearsal, the more Greg and I talked about this idea. And the guy I share the role with, we talked about the fact that he has worked very hard at keeping two separate worlds. You know, he has his, what he considers his wife. I mean, you know, it's so funny, those scenes feel like a marriage. Who is African-American? And then he has his white family. And his white family, his mother is racist. No two ways about it, you know. And his father, who has passed, was a member of the Knights of the Gold Carnation. You know, he left that organization. So you can, at least you find that in the play. But what happens is his worlds collide. He's been keeping these two worlds separate, and they collide when he contracts influenza because he literally ends up in her bedroom. And already a white man in a black woman's bed, that's a bad thing, you know. And his family has to show up in Julia's bedroom, you know. Mm-hmm. So,
and that's why I think one thing that's brilliant about the play is the price of racism across the boards, mm-hmm. not just how it affects the African-American community, but also immigrants. I mean, we talk about Asians in it. We talk about Germans in it because there's a lot of animosity toward Germans because obviously we're at war with them. So the price that's paid in our own humanity just doesn't affect one race. It affects a broad, and that's why I think this is a uniquely American mm-hmm. story, mm-hmm. because it affects the politics of race, the politics of intolerance and bigotry goes right across the boards. We talk about Asians, we talk about Germans, we talk about every other.
Nobody's safe.
And it's brilliant how this black woman at that time in the 60s was when she wrote it about 1918, how she was able to step back from her own and say, okay, this is a pastiche of American society that I really think we need to take a look at and head on the legacy of the Klan, Mm-hmm. The legacy of anti-miscegenation laws, which was legislated, and they weren't overturned until 1967 in the famous Loving versus West Virginia, when the Supreme Court overturned them. So this is part of the part and parcel, our DNA, and we have to take a look at it before we can have any further conversation about racial relationships in this country.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Greg T. Daniel, the director of the play Wedding Band, A Love-Hate Story in Black and White by Alice Childress. And we're also talking with two of the cast members, the two leading cast members, Verilyn Jones and John Prosky. You know, that's a really important point. And one of the things that I thought about, Alice Childress, for instance, she was just amazing as a writer. Mm-hmm. And the fact that this play, when it was first written, could not get produced.
No, right.
And then it couldn't be performed in New York for a very long time. Right. I think it was written when, in 62 or 63?
Yeah. In 62.
Well, she had the audacity to write about a relationship between a black woman and a white man. I really feel in my soul it would have been different if it had been maybe a black man and a white woman. But because she wrote about a black woman and a white man, there's something that stood on the backs of people's necks. Says, no. And obviously later on, Lorraine Hansberry famously did Raisin in the Sun, but that was okay. Mm-hmm. Something about this that made it so incendiary that producers did not want to touch this material.
Right. Well, then when ABC ran it on TV, eight of their affiliates said, nope,
no,
that's it.
We're not going to. Yeah.
So what was so threatening about this relationship in the 60s that no one wanted to, even in under a drama, mm-hmm. under the literature or whatever, they didn't want to touch it. What?
No.
Well, you know, one thing that got me too is that, and was it John C. Calhoun that you were?
Oh yeah,
John.
Yeah,
there's that point, and then Verilyn, there's the point where your character has that nightmare, mm-hmm. and starts talking about I see all those who were killed,
all the dead slaves.
And then there's this confrontation between John and Verilyn's character saying, mm-hmm. "Look, you know, I didn't do it. Mm-hmm. Yes, you did. Yeah. You know, and there's that that runs through it because." One of the things that I thought in the play is that you have, when we're talking about the bigger story that gets told, you're talking about a story that all those people who are sort of, you could say, okay, well, they're sort of side characters on the play. And it, to a certain extent, yeah, they're not the lead. It's not their story, but it is their story. Mm-hmm. Because you're getting all the various ways that this all comes out, including with the one black male character in it,
mm-hmm.
who actually is crushed by thinking that you know, here he is in the military fighting World War I, and he's being told that you've got nothing of value to me, mm-hmm. to anybody, you know? Right.
And we find out in World War II, when black men returned from fighting in Europe, of course, where they were more or less accepted, saying they come back to America, and the first thing they do, they take away their weapons, and they are now mm-hmm. back to being second-class citizens.
Or World War I, where you have the bombing of Tulsa, and exactly. all these other things mm-hmm. that people had to face up around.
But you said something important also, which was part of Julia's journey, is realizing she is a part of all those women. Mm-hmm. That's part mm-hmm. of her journey, that those what seems like subsidiary characters of different socioeconomic hues, they are part of Julia, and she has to acknowledge that, and Herman has to acknowledge that mm-hmm. before they can truly come together and have an intimate relationship. You know, she is part of the uneducated ones. I mean, all her people, all the black women, she is part of, and she's been sort of keeping that at arm's length, but part of her journey is acknowledging by the end. Just as his racism, his parents is acknowledging, yeah, I remember the John C. Calhoun speech. Was part and parcel of my, but yeah. I've chosen to turn away from it, which is so wonderful. I've always liked Herman's character in this play.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's complicated. He's complicated because he had early racist brainwashing. Mm-hmm. You know, mother beat him
to learn
the John C. Calhoun speech, which is a highfalutin Civil War language that is justification for...
It's vile, you know, yeah. It's pretty vile.
Yeah.
And him acknowledging that at some point, that she, this is what I did in trying to help the situation. I kind of made it tougher for her.
I denied it. It's funny. Herman, what he keeps on saying to Julia every time she says, wasn't she a mean white woman? He's like, Julia, just say she was mean.
Yeah.
She'd say black people. He's like, no, Julia, let's just say people. Yeah. So he wants his world clean of that.
Well, it's the only way that he could really have this relationship.
Right.
You can't have both in this situation because it's not allowed. And to have when she says in the big argument in the second act when she tells him I'm just like all of the other colored women, he for some reason I don't think he always says to his but she's different. Mm. And that was a question I always had for dealing when we're in rehearsals. What does that mean basically when that's being said by Herman? She's different.
Mm-hmm.
Is she different because she needs to be different for him even to be able to have this relationship with her? So So that's very explosive.
It's loaded with so many racial. Yes.
And by the same token, Herman, who also you think, Julie thinks that Herman is different. And it's said a couple times in the play of like, he's different. He's not like those. He's not out just for me and my body and whatever. You know, he's different.
He loves me.
And
mm-hmm.
then, but then in a move where it becomes sort of the subconscious and you're sick and you're delirious, but you start reciting the John C. Calhoun speech.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, just so people know, Herman won a prize for reciting that speech at a KKK rally.
Right.
Okay.
$10 gold piece.
When he was a youngster.
$10 gold piece.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the thing is that all of these things that are still sitting there very much and have to be dealt with, and the things that we in society at large have to deal with, we have to deal with the legacy of what it means that an entire people, one, was kept in slavery, and two, has suffered the most massive, inhumane oppression in the history of this country, mm-hmm. you know, and continues to do so today. I mean, let's talk about what happens to young black men in mm-hmm. this country right now. You know?
And the casualties we all pay. I mean, it's not, again, everyone pays part of the society as a result of that inhumane treatment. Everyone, black, white, mm-hmm. it's just, you can't isolate a group and call them American and say you're an American. It's got to be everybody who participates and understands that we all pay a cost if we participate in this.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to have to jump in here now. I wish we had another half hour to talk. I'll have you guys back and you can talk.
Please.
That'd be
right.
Really good. I'd really like that. But I want to remind listeners that I'm talking with Greg T. Daniel, the director of the play, and Verlyn Jones and John Prosky, the two lead cast members of the play Wedding Band, a love-hate story in black and white. I want to thank all of my guests today, and I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. You want to write to me, you can at michaelslade@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslade@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with, I'm going to go out with How I Got My Brains Back, because that's what I feel this show did to me today. Helped me get my brains back, all right? So, take care.